following program is brought to you by your friends at Podcast One.
Welcome. You're tuned into the best in paranormal talk radio. This is Beyond the Darkness. I'm your host, Dave Schrader. Along with me, Tim Dennis. Hello, Tim.
Hello.
Another week come and gone, my friend.
Yes,
hard to believe.
Yeah, I know.
I mean, I feel like we were just starting the week together, and it's already done. These months are flying by too quick. 2018, I don't even remember. It was a blur. And we're already a quarter of the way through 2019.
Yeah, I know. They're going quick. They really are going quick.
It's crazy. Well, we've got a good show for you lined up here. Michael T. Keene is the author of 8 books about the unusual but true stories, including his most recent work, New York City's Heart Island, A Cemetery of Strangers. We'll talk about that a little bit later on in today's program. But Michael is also the producer of the documentary video Visions, True Stories of Spiritualism, Secret Societies, and Murder, as well as 8 audiobooks. We enjoyed having him on True Crime Tuesday this past week. He is joining us tonight to talk about this documentary, Visions, True Stories of Spiritualism, Secret Societies, and Murder. And it's a pleasure to have you back. Thank you for doing this, Michael. It's nice to kind of bookend our week with you on Tuesday and ended up here on Sunday.
Thank you, Dave.
Let's get into the information about the documentary. I mean, this is cool. It's an award-winning film, first of all, and you kind of focus on kind of the political, social, and religious movements back in the 19th century. Everything from the Masonic secrets, murder and conspiracies, Native American folklore, and the paranormal. So it's really kind of got a little bit of everything that our listeners love so much. So we will have a link up to your website on our page. So if people want to go and buy the books, buy the DVDs, it's all there for them. Make it very easy and under one place for them to go. It'll be right on today's podcast link, so you guys can check it out there. But Michael, let's, you know, starting to get into this, why such a mixed genre of a documentary? Most times documentaries focus on one specific thing. I love that this has a kind of a different vibe to the whole flow. But what kind of encouraged you to take that approach in telling the story?
Right. I guess if I knew from the beginning of what everything like this would have ended up to be, maybe I wouldn't have done it in the first place. But we have to flash back 15 years ago. And at that time, I was a mild-mannered financial planner working for a rather large financial services company. But I always had an interest in history. And so just for fits and giggles, I decided to look into the history of Rochester, New York. Reason being, that's where I lived and that's where I worked. And as I did, I began to find strands of a story that unfolded over a period of about 4 years. So it wasn't that it all came to me at one time. And I suppose the best place to begin, as they say, is at the beginning. There was a fellow by the name of John C. McCurdy, who in 1901 comes to Rochester to seek fame and fortune. That was his objective. He had moved from Philadelphia, where he had lived and where he had become a very successful businessman. But he had sold all of his business interests. And for 6 months, he traveled up and down the East Coast of the United States, seeking a new destination for his next venture. Now, the fact that he chose Rochester, New York, I don't know if most people know where that is, but that's way upstate New York. It sits on the on the mouth of Lake Ontario, one of the five Great Lakes. It's right in between Buffalo and Syracuse. We get about 150 inches of snow every year, whether we need it or not. And not only would people who are not from Rochester wonder why he chose Rochester, but even people who live there wonder. But when you delve into the history of Rochester, New York, it's perhaps not so surprising that this McCurdy fellow chose to land there. For during the 19th century, Rochester was one of the fastest growing cities in the United States. In fact, by 1860, literally on the dawn of the Civil War, Rochester was bigger than Chicago. Now, there's a whole host of reasons why this was the case, but perhaps first and foremost, it was right in the way of the Erie Canal. Now, again, most people are not that familiar with the Erie Canal, but at its time, when it was originally completed in 1824, it was the largest man-made waterway in the United States, over 350 miles long, and it essentially connected via the Hudson River, the Atlantic Ocean, with Lake Erie in Buffalo, and therefore was the gateway to the western part of the United States. So literally manufacturing goods manufactured in Europe could be sold in St. Louis. And as a result of that, the cost of transportation, of transporting goods, fell by 90%. And along the Erie Canal, many cities came to be. In fact, Rochester was one of them. Certainly Syracuse, another one, Buffalo, and many other cities. In fact, on Tuesday, we talked about Utica, New York, which is where all these strange female serial killers were congregating. That's also lies on the Erie Canal. And the Erie Canal has been thought for many, many years to have psychic properties. As a matter of fact, I wrote a book about it, which I have on my website, The Psychic Highway, which is another term for the Erie Canal. And the reason being...
Right, I got to hear this.
During the 19th century, some of the major religious, social, and political movements that came about occurred in Rochester, New York. And not only that, but it all happened within about a 30-year period. The anti-Masonic movement, the spiritualism movement, the anti-slavery movement, the women's rights movement. I mean, I can go on and on. And it all happened in Rochester. So the Erie Canal was very significant in this regard. So anyway, our intrepid entrepreneur, John C. McCurdy, comes to Rochester in 1901. And the first thing he does, which I find rather interesting, is that he conducts an analysis of the traffic patterns in downtown Rochester. Now, traffic, as it were, back in 1901, consisted largely of pedestrians, horse-drawn wagons and carriages, but also a fairly advanced trolley system. And McCurdy comes to a rather controversial conclusion that retailing, which was the business that he was in, was going to bloom and grow primarily on the eastern part of the city of Rochester rather than the western part, which is where most commerce was already headquartered. Not only that, but he determines that the exact epicenter of retailing would take place at a particular intersection of downtown Rochester in 1901. And that intersection was Main and Elm Street. Of course, you're not from Rochester, you don't necessarily know where that is. But as you might expect, just like any other traditional early 20th century city, it was a fairly small street corner. And as fate would have it, there was a business there for sale. And the business was a department store, which the owner wanted to sell lock, stock, and barrel, which was exactly the business that McCurdy wanted to enter. So McCurdy made his intentions known that he wished to purchase that business. And then an utterly, I would say, bizarre series of events began to occur. Not only so bizarre that it affected McCurdy and the rest of his life, but in a very real sense, it affected me and the rest of my life. And what those what the major occurrence was that a number of the area merchants who operated in and around Main and Elm Street approached McCurdy and warned him not to buy the business. For it was believed by the merchants of the day that anyone who operated a business at the corner of Main and Elm Street was doomed for failure. In fact, they had a rather colorful phrase for it, that it would fall on the shoals of destruction. And not only that, but it was called back then, the corner of Main and Elm Street, Hoodoo Corner, H-O-O-D-O-O, Corner. Okay. Well, McCurdy, undaunted by this superstition, buys the business anyway. And for all intent and purposes, it becomes a huge success. As a matter of fact, some people believe that as a privately owned store, that McCurdy's department store would go on to become one of the most successful departments, privately owned department stores in the nation, for it would remain in business for the next 90 years and would be operated by four successive generations of McCurdy's. Well, but I began to become quite curious as to, as you might expect, as to what was this Hoodoo Corner business? What happened at the corner of Main and Elm Street prior to 1901 for people to believe this? And so that's
right, because again, I understand that was a different time. People were a lot more spiritual. People are a lot more superstitious, but it seems like that's a pretty overwhelming response to that area.
I would think so. You know, one of the things that I like to highlight is the type of research that I do when I explore these historical episodes. And that I only rely upon original sources. So, for instance, the story about John C. McCurdy and the Hoodoo Corner comes to light in his obituary when he dies in 1931, 30 years later, and befitting his stature as one of the most prominent business people in all of Rochester. He has a front page obituary, including his picture. And in that obituary, it's highlighted about this Hoodoo Corner business. So I thought, you know, this probably will be fun to research. I'm sure there's not a lot to it. Let me take a look. And little did I realize that it would occupy the next 5 years of my life. It would cause me to make four historical documentaries, which at the end, I put them all together into one master documentary. And in its own way, would lead me to begin book writing, which now, 15 years later, has resulted in 8 books and, of course, all my audiobooks. So let me tell you what I found out.
Please do.
Corner of Main and Elm Street. Murder, outrage, assassination. There's a stain upon the land. On the evening of October 20th, 1837, at approximately 9 p.m., and if you will, remember that time, 10-year-old Thomas Dixon was walking home from work. Now, times have changed a little bit since then. You know, when 10-year-olds were walking home from work at 9 o'clock at night.
And boy, those were the good old days.
Wasn't it?
Yeah. It's a, yeah.
before iPhones and all that kind of stuff. He was walking down Main Street. And as he got to the intersection of Main and Clinton, which was one block from our hoodoo corner, he began to hear a dog bark. And as he progressed further towards Elm Street, he heard a gunshot. And as he looked towards the sound of the shot, there was an instant explosion of light. And in a brief moment of light, he saw the silhouette of a man who Dixon would later tell police was wearing a shiny hat. The man then suddenly bent down, frightened Master Dixon, who then ran home. The following morning, Thomas Dixon got up earlier than he normally would and went outside and began looking for the body of what he believed to be the barking dog, which he surmised is what the man had shot the night before. And as he turned the corner of his where he lived, he suddenly saw the body of a man lying face up. His pockets were turned inside out, and his money and wallet were gone. Lying a few feet away from the man's body was his hat. Underneath his hat, it was later found $5,000 in banknotes. Now, $5 or $5,000 in banknotes in 1837 would be the equivalent of about $750,000 today. And you can imagine if a crime like this occurred today in the middle of a city, prominent businessman shot to death, and lying a few feet away was his hat with $750,000 under his hat. You can imagine the uproar.
Right.
The man had been shot at close range behind his head and had been killed instantly. The man's name was William Lyman. He was 38 years old. He was married and had four children. William Lyman became the first person ever murdered in the city of Rochester, New York. So the hue and cry as a result of this was tremendous. The police, the entire 11-man Rochester Police Department, immediately began canvassing the area, looking for, based on the description of the shiny hat that was given to them by Thomas Dixon, that the man was probably one of those foreigners, as they were called back then, who had come down from Canada to work along the Erie Canal. Now, Rochester was a booming city in 1837. 13, 14 years after the completion of the Erie Canal. And they knew where these foreigners, as they call them, hung out, which was along State Street, another area of Rochester, that was populated by saloons. And so they went into the very first saloon, and they began questioning people, and no one had seen anything or noticed anything except for a woman by the name of Hannah Chamberlain, who was a seamstress and who actually the night before was working on the second floor above the saloon as a seamstress. And she approached the police and she told them that as she was leaving work that night, the night before, she happened to look down onto the first floor and she saw a a group of three men sitting at a table drinking brandy with money lying on the table, and they were whispering to one another and looking all around as if in conspiratorial partnership. And she said that she had actually seen one of those men before and knew him by the name of Baron. Well, now armed with a name, the police began to canvass the area where these French Canadians, as it turned out, congregated. And as they did, a police whistle sounded by the railroad yard only a block away. And as they ran there, there was a policeman who had arrested a man who was found hiding behind a stack of wood. And in the man's pocket was a handkerchief. And in the handkerchief was $500 of banknotes that matched the $5,000 of banknotes that was found under William Lyman's hat. The man's name was Octavius Baron, and he was immediately arrested and charged with the murder of William Lyman. About 9 months later, the trial was held. It lasted about 10 days. 40 witnesses were called, including Octavius Baron's mother, who refuted his alibi that he had been home the night of the murder. She also identified the handkerchief that contained the $500 in banknotes as belonging to her son. The defense lawyer had a two-hour summation after the trial. The prosecuting attorney had a three-hour summation, and the judge's charge to the jury consumed four more hours. The jury deliberated for just 45 minutes and found Octavius Baron guilty and sentenced him to death. 30 days later, on the morning of his execution, wearing a ruffled shirt and a white roundabout and being escorted by two priests saying prayers in Latin and French, Octavius Baron walked into the death chamber. Now, the reason we know exactly what happened is because there was a court reporter in there who wrote an article about it the very same day of the execution. And according to the court reporter, Octavia Baron's countenance betook great horror, but there was no trembling. And when he died, he was holding a Catholic cross in his right hand. Well, there is the murder of William Lyman, the arrest, trial, and execution of his killer. What I found, though, which was the murder, took place on Hoodoo Corner at the exact intersection of Main and Elm Street. But Octavius Baron achieved a number of many firsts, as it turned out. One was, of course, he was the first murderer in Rochester, having murdered the first person ever murdered. He was the first person ever executed in Rochester. In fact, people from Rochester were rather shocked to learn that there were executions right downtown in Rochester. He became the first person ever executed in the manner in which he was executed in the United States. And as it turns out, he was the first person ever buried in a place called Mount Hope Cemetery, which had just opened up that very summer. And he was buried in a pauper's grave or area. I didn't find this out until after I was taking some photographs at Mount Hope Cemetery, because a number of the protagonists, not only to this story, but to the other stories that I've done, are buried at Mount Hope Cemetery. It's a beautiful cemetery. It's, of course, rather old, having been established in 1838. And as I was taking the photographs, I happened to notice two gravestones leaning towards one another, almost touching. And I took a picture of it, and I put it into my book, Folklore and Legends of Rochester, The Mystery of Hoodoo Corner, which becomes the book that I wrote after I made the last of my documentaries, which ties this whole story together. And so at Mount Hope, when you go into the guard shack there, they have a register of every person, and there's over 300,000 people buried here.
Wow.
A register of every person ever buried at Mount Hope, when they were buried, what they died of, and the area in which they're buried in. One of the things that nagged at me was what happened to our poor William Lyman, because he was not from Rochester. He was actually from Massachusetts. And what I learned is that upon his death, he was buried in a cemetery called West Cemetery. It was another area of Rochester. But 20 years later, they closed West Cemetery. And they took the bodies, they disinterred everyone buried there, and they transported him to Mount Hope Cemetery. And so in 1857, 20 years after the murder, William Lyman is literally dug back up and re-buried at Mount Hope. When I looked at the register to see where he was buried, and when I talk about it now, it still sends chills up and down my body. He was buried right next to Octavius Barron, his murderer. So when I was done with the story, I thought that I had figured out the origins of Hoodoo Corner, why the corner of Main and Elm Street were called Hoodoo Corner. And then I made a documentary about called The Murder of William Lyman. And as it turned out, the documentary proved to be quite popular. And for my dialogue, I managed to find, this is another thing that sent things up and down my spine. I found the original 1838 court transcripts, which were still being housed at the local Rochester downtown library. And I'll never forget when they delivered this little package to me. I'm sitting at a desk, and they didn't even know they had this transcript. And as I unbound, and they were held together by a blue ribbon, as I unbound this document, it just literally fell open in front of me. I realized that I was probably the first person to see this transcript since the trial itself.
Right.
So when we talk about what happened during the trial, when we talk about what happened during the execution phase, when we talk about the eyewitnesses to this case, it all comes from the original court transcripts. And so the murder of William Lyman becomes a rather local cause celeb. The documentary, we win all kinds of awards as the best movie, which, you know, for me, I'm the mild-mannered financial planner. My intention was not to go into the movie-making business, although I always thought that would be the coolest thing to do. And so I had a lot of fun. And I thought that was the end of it. But along the way, doing the research on William Lyman, I came across another story about a fellow by the name of William Morgan.
All right, we'll start up with that story in just a minute. First, if you like our show, you're going to love Reasonable Doubt on Podcast One. Join the world-renowned criminal defense lawyer Mark Garagos as he reviews the latest in our nation's most high-profile legal cases with podcast king Adam Carolla. You can download Reasonable Doubt every Saturday right here on Podcast One. Listen, this is something we all know about. Not just the great show that you're listening to now bringing you the scares, but what about Sunday Scaries, Tim? Have you ever had to deal with a case of Sunday scaries?
Oh, yes, I have.
That's that feeling of just impending doom for the upcoming next work week, when you're dreading your responsibilities, questioning your entire existence. Did you spend too much money over the weekend? Maybe you sent a text you regret. Did you drink too much? Maybe you procrastinated at work or on a homework assignment. Maybe you even forgot to pay the bills. Well, Sunday scaries makes these daily anxieties not so scary, and they allow you to enjoy the now. Sunday Scaries gummies provide a calm, clean sense of relief and mild euphoria. Sunday Scaries are a healthy, non-habit-forming remedy for dealing with life's little nuances. These CBD gummies are custom formulated with 10 milligrams of blend of broad spectrum and isolate CBD, as well as vitamins B12 and D3 for mood boosters. They're made with natural ingredients, and they're free of gluten, dairy, yeast, egg, soy, and peanuts. All that's left is pure goodness. Sunday Scaries can be ordered online from their website, sundayscaries.com. SundayScaries.com, and shipped directly to your front door. There are also subscription packages for recurring monthly orders at a much discounted rate. And right now, my listeners can buy Sunday Scaries with a 10% discount plus free shipping at sundayscaries.com. Make sure to use promo code DARKNESS. That's sundayscaries.com, and use promo code DARKNESS to get 10% off and free shipping. Don't forget the code DARKNESS, DARKNESS. Listen, it's something that I use, Tim uses. It helps me with my anxiety. You're going to absolutely love it. Try it now, sundayscaries.com, and use code word DARKNESS. Michael Keane, our guest here on Beyond the Darkness. All right, Michael, where are we going next with the story?
We're not a secret organization.
Right.
We're an organization with secrets. On the night of September 12th, 1826, at approximately 9 p.m., remember, I asked you to remember that time.
That's right.
Three men showed up at the Canandaigua jailhouse. Canandaigua, a small town, not too far from Rochester, to pay the fine for William Morgan, who was a Batavia man, again, not far from Rochester, who had been arrested days earlier for the non-payment of a $2.60 shirt and tie. According to the jailer's wife, who observed this event from the top floor of the jailhouse, Morgan was put into a waiting horse-drawn carriage, which then quickly sped off into the night. It would be the last time anyone ever saw or heard from William Morgan, for it would be believed until this day that Morgan had actually been kidnapped by a group of Rochester Freemasons, taken to Fort Niagara, which is near Buffalo, and drowned in order to prevent him from publishing a book that would reveal the inner secrets of the Masonic Order. As the consequence of this event, 90% of all the Masonic lodges in New York State, including the Grand Lodge of Rochester, would shutter its doors. And in the consequently, a total of 57 men would eventually be arrested. 28 of them would be indicted, 10 of them would be brought to trial, and 3 were eventually convicted. Their sentence was only 1 year in jail, for back in 1826, for kidnapping, was only a misdemeanor. As the direct result of this case, the apparent kidnapping and murder of William Lyman, the nation's first third political party was established, which was called the Anti-Masonic Party. And it would run an individual by the name of William Wirth. But by the way, you have to be careful when you do this kind of research, because at some point it seemed like everybody I ran into, his name was William. but William Wirth was run as the presidential candidate in 1832 against Andrew Jackson. And Wirth would eventually garner almost 100,000 votes. Now, based on today's population, that would be the equivalent of about 7 million votes. After the election, which Wirth, of course, did not win, the anti-Masonic party would morph into the Whig party, which eventually would become the base for the Republican party, and, of course, would nominate Abraham Lincoln for president in 1860. So I learned about the basic outline of the apparent kidnapping of this Mason, William Morgan, which today is still considered the greatest of all conspiracy mysteries, and that it was believed that it was the Mason who kidnapped him and murdered him. And I thought that was the end of the story. But there's more, right? There's never, ever the end of the story. I happened to be reading a newspaper article that was actually literally written in 1848. And here's what this article said. That on a very cold and wintry night at, do I need to tell you what time this happened?
Would I guess 9, right?
You're close. You're very close. The Lima Masonic Lodge. Lima is another one of these small little towns, about 30 miles from Rochester, was meeting secretly on the third floor of a place called the American Hotel. Again, 90% of all of the Masonic lodges in the entire state of New York had closed because of this kidnapping. All of the Masonic lodges in Livingston County, which is where Lima is situated, had closed. And still, 20 years after the kidnapping of Morgan, the disappearance of Morgan, Masons were so frightened of the blowback that they were getting that in this particular case, they had to meet secretly on the third floor of this hotel. Upon leaving their meeting room that night, the Masons discovered that their overcoats were missing. 1 month later, upon leaving their meeting on the third floor of the American Hotel, they discovered their previously missing overcoats were now neatly piled upon the floor just outside the door, held together by twine with a note attached. The note read that a Lima citizen had found the coats and, realizing that they were owned by the Masons, wanted them returned to their rightful owners. But unbeknownst to the Masons there that night, those previously missing overcoats had been intentionally infected with smallpox. And all of those Masons, save for one, came down with that dreaded contagion. Well, when I read this, two thoughts came to my mind. One was, holy cow, you mean to tell me that 20 years after this event, the apparent kidnapping of William Morgan, that emotions ran so high that people tried to murder every single Mason in Livingston County? Maybe there was more to this story than I had originally thought. But then I had a double holy moly, for I realized that this event, which happened in 1848 at the American Hotel in Lima, New York, that the American Hotel still exists to this day. And not only that, but I knew the people who owned it. So I decided to take a little trip to Lyman, New York, to talk to Pat and Rose Reynolds, the two people who owned, their brother and sister. By the way, if you can ever get him on one of your shows, he can tell you some ghost stories firsthand, because this hotel has been there since 1795. It's burned down three times, but it's always been rebuilt on exactly the same location. I mean, they would just really curl your hair. But anyway, I go there, and Pat says, oh, yeah. I mean, this is like a casual conversation at the American Hotel. You know, they knew all of it. And this is where I learned some of the ghost stories there, too. He says, but you know what? If you really want to find out more about this whole story, you should talk to the worshipful master of the Lima Masonic Lodge. And that is the person who's head of the Lima Lodge. And it was the Lima Lodge where this all happened. And the Lima Lodge, Masonic Lodge, is the oldest continuously operating Masonic Lodge in New York State. And so I meet, his name is Jim, and I meet with Jim and tell him what I'm doing. And he's tickled pink. He had seen my documentary, The Murder of William Lyman. And so I had some cred, you know, there. And he said, you know what? Not for nothing, but we've known this story forever, and we've always wondered what the hell happened. So he invited me to come to the Masonic Lodge the following Saturday, where I had access to all of their historical documents, and he would allow me unfettered access. The first non-Mason, by the way, from what I later learned, to have this kind of access. So the following Saturday, I meet him, excuse me, and a fellow that I'll call the Keeper of the Keys. He was a much older fellow, and he happened to be the guy who had all the keys to the Masonic Lodge. So he had the key to the front door. We come in. We have to climb up to the third floor. Everything on a Masonic Lodge, by the way, happens to occur on the third floor. And as we get to the top of the floor, a third floor, there's another door which he unlocks and enables us to come into a room about the size of a rather large living room. And off of this room were three doors. And we go immediately to the door to the left, which is locked. He unlocks that door, which takes us into a hallway. And off of the hallway are four more doors. But he turns immediately to the door on the left, which is locked, and he unlocks that door, which takes us into a closet. And there, sitting in the middle of the closet, is one of these ornate 19th century safes. Upon seeing the safe, the keeper of the keys reaches into his pocket, takes out his wallet. In very yellowed paper is the combination to the safe. And the keeper of the keys tells me, and Jim, who's with us, that he had been the keeper of the keys for 50 years. And that he had been given the keys by the previous keeper of the keys, plus the combination to the safe. The previous keeper of the keys, though, had never opened the safe. Reason being, he had no reason to. I guess it makes sense. And he had been the keeper of the keys for the 50 years previous. Okay? So after two, three attempts, he finally is able to unlock the safe. And when he opens up the door of the safe, there are just hundreds of documents, old books, all kinds of printed material. And in the middle of this safe is a door, a little door, which, of course, is locked. And he takes out, and he doesn't know exactly which key is going to fit this lock, but he takes out one of the very small keys, and it unlocks this door. Inside the little cubbyhole of this locked door is a little tiny leather-bound book. And in the middle, in the middle of the book is a lock. So he takes out the smallest little key that he has, and he unlocks the book. And then Jim says to me, Mike, you now have access to stuff that none of us has ever seen, plus all of the other documents that were in other closets and other rooms and so on. And so for the next two Saturdays, I was scrolled away at the third floor of this Masonic Lodge going through all of the material, including what was in the lockbook. And I have to tell you that in the lockbook was what really happened to William Morgan.
Really?
And so, yeah. So, being now a very successful documentary movie producer, I decided to make a documentary about the strange disappearance of Captain William Morgan. And I can't tell you the whole thing of what happened, because that would be, you know, be a reason not to get the documentary or maybe read the book. But
right.
But one of the things that I learned is that if you were, quote unquote, kidnapping somebody from the Canandaigua jailhouse, and you wanted to take him to Fort Niagara, which is in Buffalo, to murder that person, there were two ways you could get there. One way was the most direct route, which is along what is still called Routes 5 and 20, which used to be the old mail route back in 1826. And so because being the most direct route, it was the shortest route, but it was the most heavily traveled. And when it became known that Morgan had disappeared, the local law enforcement people along this route, which was 60, 70 miles long, would have been at high alert. But there was a second way to get to Fort Niagara, a little bit out of the way, but much less travel. And that way brought you into a little town, again, outside of Rochester, called Pittsford, New York. And there was a road that was called the Pittsford Road, which brought you into Rochester. And as you go along the Pittsford Road, you come into Rochester, and you come to the intersection of Main and Elm Street. And in 1826, this was long before McCurdy's department store was built, known as Hoodoo Corner. It was 11 years before the murder of William Lyman at the corner of Main and Elm Street. But on that corner was an old hotel. It was called the Farmer's Tavern and Inn. And it was believed, and I have the documentation, that the so-called kidnappers and William Morgan decided to spend the night at the Farmer's Tavern and Inn at the corner of Main and Elm Street. And it was during that night that it's alleged that William Morgan died. And also that for many years after, it was believed that Morgan haunted one of the rooms of the Farmer's Tavern and Inn. And it was believed so severely that that room was never rented out, even during periods of high demand. And that hotel was in very high demand because it was on the route of the Erie Canal. And in fact, somebody wrote a story about it called The Noisy Ghost. For it was believed that every night, must we say, at 9 p.m., that noises would begin to emanate from that room, and that suddenly a person would come out of the room and which would cause everyone in that, on, by the way, this was also on the third floor, would come running out of the hotel into the street, scared to death, believing that they were being chased by the ghost of William Morgan. So I said, that's kind of interesting. This whole
just kind
anti-Masonic party, this whole the greatest conspiracy theory ever. By the way, Illuminati and you know, every conspiracy that's believed anywhere on earth, I don't care whether it's 9/11, the Kennedy assassination, you name it, the granddaddy of them all is the strange disappearance of Captain William Morgan. And incredibly, it had a connection, the second connection that I was able to find that took place at the corner of Main and Elm Street, or Hoodoo Corner. And so, of course, I made a documentary about it. We did something that was a lot of fun. It was my first attempt at live action directing and filming. And we filmed the scene at the American Hotel. By the way, I'll just throw this in. There's so many little things I could tell you. That it was believed because the American Hotel was on the route of 5 and 20, which was this mail route. One of the stories that I read in the little lock book was, and this will just give you a flavor because the complexity of this story is delicious. There's so many moving parts. That a year after Morgan was allegedly, and I don't know if you have caught on to the fact that I've been saying allegedly,
right?
A farmer, a Lima farmer, this is now in 1827, a year later, is coming into town with a wagon load of produce to sell. And as you get about a mile from Lima, there's an old farmhouse. By the way, this farmhouse still exists, and I'll tell you an interesting little story about it. But anyway, so he's about a mile from Lima, and he comes to this farmhouse. And as he's going by the farmhouse, he happens to glance up at the attic window, which would be the third floor, and swears that he sees William Morgan. This is a year after his apparent kidnapping. When I learned that, I happened to be at the American Hotel, talking to Pat Reynolds and learning about this whole thing. And so on my way home, I pass this farmhouse. In fact, there's a blinking light there. I don't know why there's a blinking light. There's no traffic or anything. And as I very slowly drove by this farmhouse and I looked up to the third floor, it's now boarded up. According to Pat Reynolds, about, I guess now it was probably 20 years ago, his sister, Rose, who is part owner of the hotel, knew the people who lived there. And one night she's over there and suddenly they began to smell what smells like pipe tobacco burning. Well, none of them smoked. And then they began to hear very heavy footsteps up above. And it was believed by the family, subsequently believed by Pat Rose Reynolds, that that pipe tobacco and those steps were from William Morgan. Well, again, that's just one of the little strands of the William Morgan story. And when I was done, again, I made the documentary, in which, you know, all these stories, and William Lyman documentary took me a year to research and film. The William Morgan story took me another year to research and film. And I thought that that was the end, that I had found these two delicious connections to my hoodoo corner. But little did I realize that I was only halfway done.
As we are, we have to take a break. Michael Keane, our guest, will come back hear more of the story and meet the Fox sisters and more. When we return, you're listening to the best in paranormal talk radio. I'm Dave Schrader. That's Tim Dennis. And this is Beyond the Darkness.
Can't keep up with all the latest scandals?
It's a bullshit question.
Then it's time to check out Reasonable Doubt on Podcast One.
I was going to unleash a torrent on anybody who was violating attorney-client privilege. I was pissed.
Join world-renowned criminal defense lawyer Mark Garagos as he reviews the latest in our nation's most high-profile legal cases with podcast king Adam Carolla.
Well, then we're circling back to MJ.
Okay.
Because I'm not done with that.
Download new episodes of Reasonable Doubt every Saturday on Podcast One.
Beyond the Darkness.
All right, welcome back to the program. This is Beyond the Darkness. I'm Dave. That's Tim. Michael Keen, our guest today. Fascinating story, and it's interesting, isn't it, Michael? I mean, you go down one storyline and it just keeps unfolding, and you're finding pieces of the story that, I mean, you know, the tendrils seem to run so deep, but you're uncovering things that have been lost to time for quite a while. Is it exciting kind of as a documentarian and an investigator to uncover this, you know, and be the first, as you said, to kind of realize you're probably the first to see these bits of information since they were first released?
Every day is like Christmas. Really, it's like being 10 years old and it's Christmas. First of all, I love meeting people. I love learning about people. And that's probably the one thing maybe that one, I don't know if it's a talent, but it's certainly an interest that I'm being interviewed now, but I love to interview people. I love to talk to, especially people that you ordinarily wouldn't even think to talk to. I have found that sometimes, I don't care where it is. You could be at an airport. You could be waiting on a street corner, and people don't expect this. But if you're polite, and you're nice, nobody minds. To be able to just suddenly say, hi, how you doing? Do you live around here? I mean, you have to be a little careful that they don't think you're some kind of weirdo. But the average person has a story to tell. In my particular case, I know where I'm going. I know where I'm looking. And so, but in meeting with Jim Lockwood, who was the master mason of the Masonic Lodge in Lima, to be able to talk to him, to learn about the inner secrets of the Masonic order, I just found tremendously exciting and interesting. And so, and same is true with perhaps this next story that we're going to get into about the Fox sisters.
All right. Well, where are we off to next? As you said, you've only found yourself halfway through the story. How does it continue to unfold here?
Here's what happened. Oh, mother, he can hear. Oh, mother, he can see. On the evening of March 31st, 1848, at approximately 9 p.m., Maggie and Kate Fox, along with their parents, were living in a small cottage in a place called Hydesville, New York, located about 30 miles from Rochester, where the entire family began to hear rapping sounds coming from the cellar of their cottage. So they all got out of bed and they went down into the cellar to investigate, but they didn't find anything. So they all returned back upstairs, went back into bed, and began hearing the sounds again. Kate, the youngest, began snapping her fingers. When she snapped her fingers twice, everyone in the family heard two rapping sounds. When she snapped her fingers once, they heard one rapping sound. When she stopped snapping her fingers, the rapping sound stopped. During the course of the evening, their father developed a crude alphabet of sorts because of the finger snapping and the rapping sounds. And at the end of the evening, they determined that the sounds that they were hearing from the cellar were coming from a peddler who had been murdered and was buried in the cellar. Now, Hinesville, New York in 1848 is a small, rural, in fact, it's still rural, community. But when word got out that this had happened, or was alleged to have happened, people came from miles around, literally pressing their faces up against the windows of the cottage to see if they could observe anything. The two younger sisters, Maggie and Kate, had a third sister who lived in Rochester. And the Mr. and Mrs. Fox thought it would be better for the two daughters to leave Hinesville, live with their older sister in Syracuse, in Rochester, in order to get away from what apparently was a haunted house. After living with their sister, the still was a huge hue and cry from now people in Rochester who wanted to learn about this story. And so Leah, who was the older sister, rented Corinthian Hall, which was the largest performing arts center in Rochester back in 1848. And a total of 400 people came to hear the two Fox sisters who were up on a stage, including Horace Greeley. And what happened is that the audience there that night heard the rapping sounds seemingly coming from the rafters of Corinthian Hall. And Horace Greeley, who again was there, determined that the girls were not the source of these sounds. The Fox sisters became celebrities. In fact, they became international celebrities, traveling to London and Paris and giving performances, as well as the major cities of New York. They also acquired quite a circle of friends, including Amy and Isaac Post, who were what are called Hicksite Quakers, an offshoot of the Quaker religion. They're also friends of Susan B. Anthony and Frederick Douglass. Frederick Douglass, of course, being the renowned abolitionist, and Susan B. Anthony being the renowned women's rights advocate. They also had another friend by the name of William Bloss. And William Bloss is an interesting fellow. He was a women's rights advocate. He was an abolitionist. He was a spiritualist. And in fact, he had a house across the street from the corner of Main and Elm Street. And his house, and there are many of these in the greater Rochester area. When you explore the history of the Underground Railroad, essentially what that was a means in which to funnel runaway slaves north, eventually into Canada. And there were two ways to do it, but one of the more prominent ways was to literally move runaway slaves along what was called the Pittsford Road, which comes right into the corner of Main and Elm Street, our hoodoo corner. And William Bloss's house was there. And he had secret passageways and false doors and walls in his house where he would hide runaway slaves. And this is one of these little things that I learned. I was doing the research that on many nights, you had runaway slaves hiding behind false walls, peopled by William Bloss, Frederick Douglass, Susan B. Anthony, Amy and Isaac Post, and the Fox sisters performing seances. And this became somewhat well known throughout the downtown Rochester area. And when asked what they thought was going on in William Bloss's house, and at that time they did not necessarily know about the runaway slaves, but they knew that these spiritualists and abolitionists and women, you know, the women's movement back then was probably as spooky to most people as maybe the spiritualism movement is. And the people all had the same phrase. I thought this was fascinating. They said, there's a whole lot of hoodoo going on over there. And so the Fox sisters, again, would become these international celebrities. But sadly, several years later, both of the two girls, Maggie and Kate Fox, became hopeless alcoholics. And in 1881, Maggie Fox confessed that she and Kate had actually been the source of the rapping sounds by being able to crack the bones in their fingers and toes. As incredible as that may seem.
That was enough to sound like rapping?
You have to figure, if we go back to Corinthian Hall, that people thought that these sounds were coming from the rafters of the building. And the two girls were literally surrounded by doctors and reporters and other skeptics who saw nothing amiss that night. The fact that Maggie Fox now would confess that they had been the source of these sounds. But like most of these stories, there's many delicious little strands and motives going through. And maybe we won't necessarily go to why I think Maggie confessed, because 1 year later, she recanted her confession. But the bloom on the spiritualism rose had come to an end. Spiritualism had its heyday, if we should call it that, primarily during the Civil War. Mary Todd Lincoln, Abraham Lincoln's wife, was a spiritualist. And many people were. And the reason was to try to explain the deaths of not only over the 600,000 soldiers who died during the Civil War, but because of the outbreak of diseases such as smallpox and cholera and so on, the young children would be dying at great rates. There were some families that if they had 10 children, three of them lived. And so many people resorted to spiritualism to be able to carry on a relationship with their children who had died. So when I came across Maggie Fox's confession and the fact she recanted, I thought that was the end of the story. And I said, well, this is interesting, but not as interesting as the murder of William Lyman or the strange disappearance of Captain William Morgan. But of course, that was not to be the case. A couple months later, I ran.
You mean there's more to the story again, Michael?
You know what? It just happened. You want to know something? I don't seek this stuff out. It seeks me. I literally believe that.
It certainly seems that way. Especially the way that every story opens up to another layer. You know, again, we've heard aspects of the Fox sisters stories before, but, you know, and some of these murders, but then the fact that it just keeps opening up to you, that you find more and more, and it's documented, and it's something that's, you know, kind of always been out there to be seen, and it just took the right person to ask those questions. It's pretty remarkable. Before we continue with the rest of the story, though, let me remind everybody that every car comes with its share of stories. That ding in your bumper when you nervously picked up a first date, that luxury package you got after a big promotion, or the mileage you saved by riding your bike all summer. While you can't put a price tag on your stories, now with TrueCar, you can at least find out what your car is worth when it comes time to sell or trade it in. Just go to TrueCar, simply enter your license plate number, and watch how your car's details pop up. Then answer a few questions. Navigation and moonroof? Watch as they bump up your value. High mileage? You already knew it was going to cost you, but now you know how much it dings your wallet, so you can plan ahead. Once you're finished, you'll get a true cash offer sent in minutes, which you can take to a local certified dealer to cash out or trade in. So when you're ready to experience a better way to sell or trade in your car, check out TrueCar today. True cash offers are not available in all areas. All right, Michael, we need to hear the rest of the story.
Both of the Fox sisters, as I mentioned, had become hopeless alcoholics. And both of them died in the 1880s at rather young ages, in their early 50s. About 10 years after the last of the Fox sisters had died, there was a small group of children who were playing in the cellar of the old Fox cottage. And they happened to notice that one of the walls of the cellar had broken in a way, and some of the stones that had made up the wall had fallen. And they ran to get their father, who came to investigate. And he found that due to an underground spring, it had caused the part of the foundation to weaken. But upon further examination, he saw that the wall that had begun to crumble was a false wall that had been built years after the original cottage had been constructed. And found behind that wall was a skeleton. And lying beside the skeleton was a peddler's trunk. Now, the reason that we know this is that 2 weeks after the original disclosure of the rapping sounds, a lawyer from Canandaigua factors into this story again. It factored into the Canandaigua jailhouse where William Morgan was being kept, who went to Hydesville, not far away, and interviewed all of the people who had ever lived in the Hydesville house, or the old Fox cottage, as it was called, because that house was a rental, as it turned out, and many people had lived there through the years. And he found people who had lived in the cottage at various times and who did not know each other, but who all described the same event, which was that at certain times they would see what appeared to be a man standing in the middle of the living room wearing an old frock coat and a stovepipe hat, carrying a peddler's trunk. And suddenly that image would disappear. So he wrote a report about this, and the report is a fascinating, I have copies of the report. It was written in 1848. It was written by the lawyer who did the investigation 2 weeks after the rapping sounds, who interviewed all the people involved. And I used his report as the basis for the dialogue of my next documentary, which was about the Fox sisters, which I titled In Search of White Crows. I've had people ask me, why was that the title, In Search of White Crows? And the answer is, which I think is a fascinating example, you know, just because we haven't seen one doesn't mean they don't exist. And not being a spiritualist, myself, again, I'm the mild-mannered financial planner who accidentally, you know, I just happened to ask the question, and lo and behold, I get the answer. And I keep on poking my head around that I learned about this story. and its connection to the corner of Main and Elm Street, which is William Bloss's hideaway for runaway slaves and the spiritualists, and which all happened at Hoodoo Corner. And so incredibly, I found the third connection to Hoodoo Corner. And when I did, I made the by the way, this documentary people really like, especially the ending, as we see what was found 10 years after the last of the Fox sisters had died.
Right. I mean, that's uncanny and weird, unless they were the ones responsible for burying him in the wall. I mean, just how strange.
I know. Now, there's also a side story to that the people who were living in the cottage before the Fox sisters went in, the woman had an affair with a peddler, and the husband killed the peddler. But be that as it may, where did the rapping sounds come from? And so, and beyond everything else, and the fact that we all have a connection to Hoodoo Corner. So I made my third documentary. This is now, I'm 3 years into the hunt. The three documentaries, that's my trilogy. You know, good things comes in threes. Or I guess bad things come in threes. And I thought that now finally I could get back to my life. You know, being the mild-mannered financial planner, people at work would look at me wondering, what is Keen up to? And, you know, it was a real cool hobby, which now has become an obsession. And to the people, but look at the people that I'm meeting. I'm meeting these historians, spiritualists, masons, people from secret societies, groups that of people that we don't necessarily know. And little did I realize that now I would meet another group of people that never in my life would I ever have the opportunity to get to know. But it would cause me to learn about the fourth and final story, the final connection to Hoodoo Corner. Would you like to hear about it?
Well, that's why you're here, Michael. What have you got for us as we wrap it up with our fourth story?
Okay. Our religion is not one of paint and feathers. It's a thing of the heart. In 1779, General John Sullivan, on the orders of George Washington, destroyed 40 Seneca towns, along with over 160,000 bushels of wheat and thousands of fruit trees. With their land lost, reduced to living on reservations, and on the verge of starvation, many Seneca, one of the six groups to the Iroquois Confederation, turned to whiskey to drown their grief. And none more so than a Seneca by the name of Handsome Lake, who had become so overwhelmed with alcoholism, he was confined to his bed for over 4 years, being tended to by his daughter. One night, and I have to be honest with you, I wish this had happened at 9 p.m., but it was the one event of all days that I couldn't pin down the time. That one night, according to Handsome Lake, he was visited by three spirit messengers sent to him by the Greek ruler in order to cure him of his alcoholism, and to teach him a new moral code that they then wanted him to go out to teach to his people. Handsome Lake subsequently rose from his bed, now cured of his alcoholism, and spent the last 15 years of his life traveling through Western New York, imparting to his people what he had learned. By the way, this moral code is still being practiced today by the Seneca. And I've met many Seneca as a result of doing the research to this story. So how do we know, for instance, that this particular event actually happened? Well, you know about the history of General John Sullivan and George Washington and the destruction of the Seneca towns and that the people were put on reservations and that they were on the verge of starvation. And we do know they turned to whiskey to drown their grief. But here's some of the research that I was able to do. As a result of his traveling and imparting this new moral code to his people, Thomas Jefferson, President Thomas Jefferson, wrote a letter to Handsome Lake, thanking him for his work in helping the Seneca. You can go online now and read this letter. It's titled, "To My Dear Brother, Handsome Lake," written by Thomas Jefferson. But there's more to this story. According to Handsome Lake, he told the story of the spirit messengers visiting him to his grandnephew, a man by the name of Owen Blacksnake, who told the story to his grandson, Edwin Cornplanter, who then told the story to a Baptist lay minister by the name of William Blue Sky. By the way, when I'm doing this research, I mean, how delicious are these names? Owen Blacksnake.
Yeah, Edwin, you can't.
Cornplanter.
You can't ask for William better Blue characters, yeah.
Who, after being told to William Blue Sky, the Baptist lay minister, wrote this all down in an old lacrosse rule book. Now, of course, lacrosse being the sport that Native Americans invented in New York, primarily upstate New York. And this old lacrosse rule book was later found and interpreted by a man called Arthur C. Parker, who was half Seneca and became the first director of the Rochester Museum and Science Center. And in 1909, he published what was found in this old lacrosse rule book called The Code of Handsome Lake. And so I would make a documentary about this basic story called The Code of Handsome Lake. And I called it The Code of Handsome Lake. And I took from my dialogue, which was no less than Handsome Lake's own words, passed down through the generations through the Seneca's great oral tradition. Because I utilized voice actors in the narration of my stories, I ended up hiring 5 Native American voice actors from all over the country. What I found is that of the 5, 4 were recovering alcoholics. The issue of alcoholism and Native Americans is a profound part of our history, and it probably explains an awful lot of the conditions that Native Americans are in today in large parts of the country. But when I was getting done with the documentary, I thought, wait a minute, what's the connection, if any, between Handsome Lake and to the corner of Main and Elm Street? What's the connection, if any, to Hoodoo Corner? Okay, hang with me for a second, because this gets a little esoteric. About 1,000 years ago, at 9 p.m., about 1,000 years ago, the Iroquois arrived in the area that we now call New York. The most prominent tribes of this confederation were the Mohawks, known as Keepers of the Eastern Door. They're in the eastern part of New York State. The Seneca were known as Keepers of the Western Door because they were on the western part of New York State. And the Onondagas were called the Keepers of the Central Council. The Seneca, and this begins 1,000 years ago, began to construct walking paths throughout western New York. in order to get from one place to another. You know, upstate New York is the home of the Finger Lakes, is the home of the Great Lakes. It's a beautiful part of New York. I mean, when people think of New York, they think of New York City, but upstate New York is a whole other world. And these walking paths would, centuries later, become the basis of some of the major highways and byways in upstate New York. If you go right along the northern part of upstate New York, there's something called the Ridge Road, which connects upstate New York, Buffalo, with Rochester and Syracuse. Much later, about 200 years ago, one of these walking paths became known as the Pittsford Road, and which then was later renamed Route 96. You can look on a map today, and you can see Route 96 as it winds its way through upstate New York into Pittsford. And as it winds its way towards the center of Rochester, and as it does, it becomes now known as East Avenue. And if you had listened to the earlier part of the story, especially the one about William Morgan, East Avenue ends at the intersection of Main Street and Elm Street. And if you're standing on that intersection, of course, you're standing where Hoodoo Corner is. And probably hundreds, perhaps even longer than that. This was long before, of course, McCurdy's department store, long before the Farmer's Tavern and Inn. In fact, long before the city of Rochester was ever founded. In that exact location, there was an ancient Native American burial ground on that site. And they designated it by a man-made stone structure that, due to hundreds of years of eccentric weathering and rain, became known as we now know as a hoodoo, thereby fulfilling my fourth story at the corner of Main and Elm Street, or my hoodoo corner.
What a fascinating trip through history. And, you know, I mean, to have one story, two stories, but it just keeps unfolding for you. Do you think that the story really has completely been told now, or do you think that there still might be a few more secrets to Hoodoo Corner yet to be unveiled?
I'm glad you asked. About a year after I finally made my fourth documentary, I do a lot of hiking, and one day I'm hiking somewhere in the middle of nowhere, probably in a forest somewhere, and I began to think about this as to, okay, four stories, all with a connection with Main and Elm Street, Hoodoo Corner. Is there any other story, or is there any other connection that ties these stories together? And literally, I can remember it, literally as I was stepping over this fallen log, it came to me of what it really all means. And so this time I decided, rather than make a documentary about it, I would write a book about it. And the book is called Folklore and Legends of Rochester, The Mystery of Hoodoo Corner. And that would have become my first book. And like everything else, after I was done with the book, I said, well, okay, I'm done. I'm done. I've got the documentaries, I've written this book, but of course it was not to be the case, because there would be something in that first book that would give me the seeds to a second story, which then becomes the third story. You know, I have to tell you now, you know, as I mentioned, I don't pick these stories. These stories pick me, quite literally. My last three books, not to get off on a tangent here, have all come about as I'm driving down the road and I'll see a sign. And that sign will cause me to look into something, because the question always is why. As long as you keep that question in front of you, you can find out anything. And so my first book, which was tying these four documentaries together, Folklore and Legends of Rochester, but in their own way, they all of them led to the next book, which leads to the next one, which leads to the next one. I had someone ask me, you know, I moved from New York. I lived all my life, and we decided to move to Nevada. Beautiful here. Lake Mead, the mountains, the desert. It's totally different than New York, totally beautiful. And I had people ask me, well, Mike, what are you going to do now? You're moving from New York. That'll be the end of your stories. That'll be the end of your New York. And I said, well, I'll just have to get on with another part of my life. But wouldn't you know it? And I don't know if we're going to get into this right now, but in the van that we're driving with all of our household goods from New York to Nevada, I get an email. And the email, another sign, by the way, is from the gal who always does the my book covers. She's great. She's an artist. She knows exactly what I want. You know, you can communicate. You work with people long enough, you're communicating on a level that you don't even need to explain, that they just know. And she says, attached to my email is a story I read in the New York Times. I thought you might be interested. And in there was the beginning of the story of Hart Island, the largest mass graveyard in American history, which now has become my eighth book. So I can't even, you know, I leave New York, I'm minding my own business, I'm in the middle of nowhere, I'm in a van, moving my stuff, and I get an email, and I said, holy moly. I said, this is a story that has to be told. And that's really what it comes down to. A lot of people ask, well, how do I do this? Well, if you just find a story that has to be told, and you believe you're the person who can tell it best, then you do it. You'll figure it out. You'll go from one thing to another, and you'll keep on asking why, and eventually you'll get the answer.
Well, give us a little taste, and we'll have you back to discuss this more in depth. I want to make sure that we give that topic its own a chance to live and breathe, but give a little taste so people understand exactly what it is.
Right. For the last 150 years, if a person turns up dead in the greater New York City area with no identification and with no one claiming the body within a couple of days, that person is transported to a small little island. It's about a mile long, quarter of a mile wide, that lies in an area called Long Island Sound, about 15 miles from downtown, you know, from midtown Manhattan, only about a mile from the Bronx, which is one of the five boroughs of New York City. This island is called Hart Island. So for the last 150 years, the destitute, the unclaimed, the forlorn are buried at Hart Island. In mass graveyards, mass graves. What they do is they come in with a bulldozer and they dig a trench and they put these poor, unfortunate souls, unembalmed for a reason, and they put them in plain $30 pine boxes. And they put 170 people at a time in these trenches. And then they cover the trenches up. Every 30 to 35 years or so, because of the fact that the bodies were not embalmed, they decomposed to a point that they can now come back in, redig that trench back up, put 170 more coffins in the same trench and covered it up. So even though we're talking about a very small geographical area, it's estimated that in this 150-year period, over 1 million people have been buried there. And And when I learned about that, the question, and again, this is my, I guess this is where I get into trouble. My question is, who were these people? What happened? How does a person end up in a mass anonymous grave? What happened to their lives that where they ended up in this particular situation? And incredibly, through fraud, bureaucratic mistakes, a whole host of reasons, there's a number of people buried there who are actually rather famous. Actors, actresses, playwrights, writers, musicians. And because of recent technology in with DNA and fingerprint technology and now better access to these records, we can now put together who some of these people were. And so in my book, Heart Island, A Cemetery of Strangers, I now have the history of Heart Island. And through the 150-year period as to what happened in New York, whether it was disease or the AIDS epidemic or wars or whatever it was that would lead these people, a million of them, to be buried there, but also the lives and biographies of some of these people. And they tell a fascinating story. I love this story. It has everything in it. It's funny. It's, of course, very sad. It's spooky. It's informative. And so that, and hopefully one of the things we might be able to do, Dave, I mean, we'll maybe talk about this. I always had the audio book version of all my books recorded. This particular one, a woman by the name of Norma Jean Gradsky, is considered to be the king of narrators for audiobooks. And so we put together 20 episodes, each one about 15 minutes long, but some of them are as short as 10, some as long as 20 minutes, but none longer than 20, at more along the lines of a podcast type arrangement, and where you can listen to each one of the chapters is narrated by Norma Jean Gradsky. I find that the book, I say so myself, well-researched and well-written. But when narrated by Norma Jean, it now suddenly is transformed into a whole nother experience. And so anyway, there's the book and then there's the audio version. But rather than listening to an audio book for 5.5 hours, which hardly anybody does, you can listen to it in maybe weekly, 10-minute increments or whatever, but in much smaller bite-sized pieces.
Well, we will include a link to your site for more information about you, about your work, and everything. Michael, thank you so much for a fascinating True Crime Tuesday this week. And if you missed it, folks, you can go over and check out our True Crime Tuesday. And if you haven't already subscribed, you should. It's the best in True Crime Talk Radio. We get some of the most fascinating guests that come on and share the real stories behind the crime headlines. And he visited with us this past Tuesday as we took a look at female serial killers, question of sanity, and hearing about some of the most bizarre cases, Avengers, Angels of Death, Black Widows, Baby Farmers, and more with Michael Keane on True Crime Tuesday here with us today. Thank you so much, Michael. We appreciate your time.
Okay, Dave. Thank you.
Thank you all for tuning in. We'll be back again with you next week with more of the best in paranormal talk radio. For Tim Dennis, I'm Dave Schrader. This is Beyond the Darkness.